Hi, I'm the self-development coach, Johnny Lawrence, and welcome to the Self-Development Podcast. Today is a good day. Today is a wonderful episode. I'm so excited to speak to my good friend, Kate Bailey. She is one half of the Love Sober team with Mandy Manners, and her wisdom today was extraordinary. I mean, she is known for Love Sober and a lot of the addictive behavior, gray area drinking stuff, but not many people realize, I don't think, that she has got an overwhelming passion for the science of happiness. And when she speaks about it, you can see that it really is it's something to witness. She has got such a passion for it. So for those that don't know Kate, she's a professional personal performance coach, say that three times fast, specializing in addictive behavior and gray area drinking. She is an associate coach trainer at the Coaching Academy. She's also the co-founder of Love Sober, co-author of Love Yourself Sober, and the co-host of the Love Sober podcast, all with the wonderful Mandy Manners. We're sort of going to start this by continuing the theme of Dry January, just to give those people that are getting late into the month now a bit of a boost and get them through to the finish line. But Kate will talk about her own journey to sobriety, what got her started with the Love Sober movement, what opportunities that Dry January presents, an explanation of the science of happiness, what the pillars of the science of happiness are, how you can start implementing it into your life, and what's the difference between the science of happiness and toxic positivity, because I think for some, they ride quite close together. And I think it's very easy to misinterpret sort of both ways of thinking. Without further ado, let's get to it.
How are you today, Kate?
Oh, thank you. What a lovely introduction. Thank you. Yeah, I'm well. We had a brief chat, didn't we, before we logged on. And it's that, is it that question that we don't ask anyone now? It's like, how are you? Because no one bloody knows, do they?
Not really.
But after all dot things and the COVID and the God knows what, it's like, I don't know. You know, I'm all right, but I am, like, we're recording this at the end of 2020. I keep saying 2022, 2021. I am knackered, I have to say.
Yeah.
I am a bit like, right, okay, I'm a bit over it all. I don't know what it is, but I'm a bit over it.
Well, from what I know and from what, you know, what we've spoken about on the course I did with you ladies, and from what I've seen on Instagram, you have been really quite busy. So
yeah, that's
so
true.
I'm not surprised.
Do you know, that's a fair cop. We have. And it's one of those sort of brilliant things. You know, when you start off with anything, any kind of project, any kind of dream, any kind of, you know, project like that, it's all about the hustle, isn't it, at the beginning. And you have that beginner's luck, you have that beginner's energy, and then something hopefully happens. Lots of things don't, do they? But sometimes when you light the taper, it really goes, and I guess it has for us over the last year. And super grateful to work in the areas that we work in. And also then it's like tending the flames. It's like managing the process and the workload. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's that. I think we're doing that, you know, the group bit where you do forming, storming, norming and performing, don't you, in group process. Yeah. And I think we've been storming. I don't know if I'll ever norm.
Well,
to be fair,
why would you want to, huh?
Why would you? Yeah, it's like, that ain't gonna happen, is it?
Yeah, and I mean even know a bit about it myself now, but like, even the podcast, as much as it's a wonderful podcast and as much as you really enjoy it, there is an element of work to it and an effort and time and stuff, and that can sometimes become, you know, tricky, can't it?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, it can, you know, but I mean, thankfully, you know, I know, like I'm doing now, you get to have conversations with some pretty amazing people.
And it's that kind of almost, well, Mandy and I have said it's a bit like therapy. It's like, it's kind of, now I wouldn't have known this when we first started of it, but it's like a reflective practice, isn't it? It's like, get to discuss things, refresh things in sobriety terms. You're quite accountable, right? Because you're quite visible. So it wouldn't look good if you kind of didn't, if I went off the rails massively. Like, do you know what I mean? I've got quite a strong buy-in to kind of keeping me on those
train really
tracks.
Have. Right?
Oh no, I'm going to freak out because I hadn't actually occurred to me. No, it has. Yeah. And yeah, it is like a reflective kind of therapeutic process. So yeah, I feel lucky to do it. And I feel lucky to have found a really good sober bestie, you know, to do all the work with. It's amazing. Yeah.
I mean, watching yours two relationship, and I only know that as someone outside looking in, but seeing the way that you two are, it's a very sisterly relationship. And obviously you share the love sober ideology in common, and it's just wonderful. And I mean, I want to say, I've said it to you. I'm not sure I've said it to you actually. Come to think of it, I've definitely said it to Mandy. You two have been instrumental in what I've been able to achieve. On the 29th of November, this last month, 1 year.
Amazing.
Yeah, 1 year. And
well done.
Well. Again, it's, you know, the timing of it was speaking to Mandy and hearing her story in person, reading up on yours, following you all on social media, and then listening to your podcast. Some of the interviews that you ladies have had have impacted me in ways that I can't imagine. But you know what's really strange is that I actually forgot.
Wow, you know what? That's amazing. What progress as well. And you know when you know when people start out with their sober journeys and it's like, right, I've just got to get today done and then I'm just gonna, and you're like, you know, you could be obsessively day counting, and what progress that actually, you know what, it went, came and went because you were living it, you know.
Well, that's why at first I was being a recovering perfectionist also. I was a little bit like, oh man, I missed it. And I was really disappointed and angry and like frustrated by it all. And then my wife said that same thing to me, like, how amazing that you've got to a point where actually you forgot. And I was just like, oh, it's a good way to look at it. So I was really happy. But what I was saying was that I'm grateful to you ladies. You've been so supportive. I've had some funny text messages with Mandy about what is classified as non-alcoholic. You know, I remember like accidentally drinking something that was 0.5% and totally freaking out. And she's like, chill out, it's all right.
Yeah.
So yeah, you guys have gone above and beyond for me, and I really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Well, you know, one day hopefully I'll be able to help you in a nice way, you know.
Oh, well, you do just by, you know, being
you. Oh, okay. Well, that was easy.
Right. See you later then. Bye. Nice chatting to you.
Well, anyway, we have a podcast to do. So the reason we're talking today really is to sort of try and offer support and value to people around initially Dry January and the idea around people stopping drinking for a month, and to try and give a bit of perspective on why you should do that, and, you know, what you can do to help yourself along that journey. And also really just to talk a bit about you at the end and some of the theories and things that you sort of are passionate about. So we're going to start with due to you being somewhat of a public figure in the sober community. Hey, look at that. Did that set off cringing?
Yeah.
What's your background, basically? I think it would be really nice for people to hear a bit about your sober journey. I think it tends to, you know, that education that you have, but also that experience is what makes you so wise in this space. So, you know, take it away.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Right. Where do I start? You know, it's interesting that the longer you go along, and I've been 8.5 years on the sober journey now.
Wow.
And it's had layers. So the way I would describe it now is really different from like a year ago or a year before that or a year before that. And I remember when Rose Romaine, who's another wonderful sober sister, she works with us at Love Sober as well sometimes. She said, when we interviewed her and said, you know, tell us a bit about your story. And she was like, it's really interesting because it changes from day to day as well, or from like morning to afternoon, depending on like how I feel. So I'm a bit like, right, well, you will get, like, I'll give you a version, but God knows if it's true or not.
I believe it's that was called a disclaimer version. That's a disclaimer. Yes.
today's take on the story, the dot story, capital letters. Yeah, so I mean, I think I was that sort of typical growing up, you know, started drinking pretty normatively around late, you know, teenage, sort of 15, 16. And it very much sort of suddenly ticked the box of sorting out anxiety for me. I was a very, very, very anxious teen. And I, again, now I know about adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs, I realise, and that was, you know, a couple of years ago I found out about that, I realised that I have a fair amount of them. Mm. But I didn't know that. So, you know, so I was quite anxious. I didn't, you know, just getting through. And I have a real significant memory, though, of when I was a teen, which I think is really pivotal. And it was my brother's engagement party. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't really drink that much, but it was suddenly we were all allowed to because it was a party. And I remember going up to the loo, and I remember looking at the wallpaper, and it was like this kind of flock, kind of awful burgundy and kind of green wallpaper sort of thing. And I remember thinking, I'm happy. Like it wasn't one of those occurrences, that I just felt happy and I felt like, all right, I felt at ease, I felt confidence. And that was my first thought, was I feel happy. And then my second thought was, oh, I'm drunk. And it was literally like, for me, I always say that the sort of neural pathway the size of the M1 was sort of created in that minute. It was like, boom, you know, happy, you know, drinking equals a happier me. And so that really kind of carried on again in that sort of quite normative way, where a lot of kids, you know, cope with anxiety with drinking. Oh, and then it turns into university stress exams, you know, and Friday night binge drinking. And it's what we did, late 80s, early 90s, fags, booze. And it didn't, I wasn't sticking out. I wasn't sticking out like a sore thumb at all. It just looked pretty normal. That kind of then the sort of ladette culture of the 90s kicked in, Sex in the City. And I was working as a photo editor and a journalist in London at that point. And so it was just cocktails after work, you know, and again, and I was like, okay, I feel like I was like a sort of like a swan on the water with the legs paddling underneath, trying to pretend I was all right, basically. Yeah. I was the kind of great pretender.
It's a nice analogy.
And I wasn't that much of a swan, to be honest. I was more like that kind of like a sad sparrow paddling on the water. No, I wasn't. But, you know, I put myself at risk. I did that, you know, like a lot of us did, you know. I couldn't remember how we got home. You know, that real sort of hazardous and harmful drinking that is so normalised, or was definitely so normalised for us at that point. And interestingly, I actually went to my first AA meeting when I was about 27. I knew that there was something there, and I went along, and I was literally surrounded by old men. It was in Hackney, I think we were. So I was like surrounded by old men. And then someone came on to me at the end of the meeting. And it was like, A, like that sucked.
Yeah.
B, that was disgusting. and it was kind of like really upsetting, but the whole thing was kind of hideous, right?
Yeah,
so that
shame.
Was it. Yeah, but then I know. And then interestingly, again, that informed the kind of what I ended up doing later on. Like, so it was all part of the process. And I'll cut a long story short. So went along. I balanced, you know, the nervous system by doing yoga. Then I'd get right royal pissed and go, right, I'm never drinking again. And this sort of relationship embedded and embedded and embedded and embedded. but in a way that was just about, all right, just about managing. And also, like, I just thought it was normal, right? Yeah. Until I had my second child, and I moved to a new town. And at that point, it just wasn't. I think I probably hit perimenopause as well. Right. So it all sort of happened in my early 40s. And my son was really small as well. And I, and where we go back to that sort of grey area drinking that we talk about, it was sort of never drank in front of the kids, you know, waited till they got to bedtime, and was really trying to make it look socially acceptable, mummy wine time, you know, did, you know, wait till 5 o'clock. So, you know, so just work, but I was working harder and harder and harder and harder just to keep it together. Oh. Couldn't cope with the hangovers. Couldn't cope with the shame. And every time, you know, say my husband worked away in London at that point, I wasn't working, I was looking after the kids. So I had that kind of cluster beep of all the identity shift, the hormones, the, you know, getting a bit older, and that longevity of use. Now that I look back over it, I was getting on to kind of however many years it was of drinking and having that as my pattern. And all the way through that, I was punctuated with me trying to stop and not managing it, and trying to stop and not managing it. And I was almost like on this hamster wheel of every 3-day cycle. Mm. I'd have a bit too much, a couple of days recovery, and then I'd say, right, I'm not drinking again. And by the third day, I felt better. And then I'd have one glass of wine that night, then it would creep up, and then I'd be back into that. I've drunk a bottle of wine, never drinking again. Do you know what I mean?
It's that, that affirmation miserable of failure, isn't it? Is that like, it's constantly again, just like, oh, I couldn't do it again. I couldn't do it again. Oh, I might as well drink, you know.
And you go down and down, you lose, and like that erodes your self-confidence. And I honestly thought that, I thought I was flaky. I thought that I was weak. I didn't understand why everybody else was kind of like, I thought everyone else was normal. Sorry, we're not norming, but I did that typical thing of I realized that there had been a profound disconnect internally, which again, I had no idea that was there because I just was doing life. I had no idea. So I was looking outside for all of my information, and nothing was coming from me, from that kind of wellspring of self, as I would put it. And what I was getting mirrored back was, it's normal. It's normal to unwind with wine. And so it's a genuine, really, really confusing time, I think, that bit where you know you've got a problem, you don't really understand the size of it, and you've sort of lost your footing. So what we naturally do is we look outside for sort of confirmation, affirmation, don't we?
Yeah.
So that's where I landed up. And that was the sort of the backstory to me stopping finally. So then the next part of it, shall I continue?
Yeah, no, please do.
Yeah. So the next part of it is I found an online forum in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you get the sweats and you can't sleep. So I googled, am I an alcoholic, for about the millionth time, and up popped Soberistas, which was this site that had a flower on it and it looked like a magazine. It was the first time I'd seen anything that hadn't scared the living daylights out of me. Oh, also I should mention, I had gone to my doctor and said, I'm concerned about my drinking, told them how much, gone to AdAction, which is, you know, like a counselling service, once I could try and get childcare. You know, so many hurdles for parents to actually, you know, get the help that they need. So up popped Soberistas, and I logged on, and I had never blogged before, and this was kind of before Instagram was a thing. Facebook was kind of, I wasn't using that social media very much, so I was like, okay, I've got a blog. So I wrote this blog in it, and it just sort of said, you know, I'm a mom, I've got 2 kids, I've never lost my driving license or a job, and, you know, I drink, you know, but two and a half bottles of wine, 3 bottles of wine a week, but I know there's a problem. Anyway, in the morning I woke up and there were about 12 responses just going, we get it, we know, we're the same as you, you know, stick with us. That was like, I felt like someone had thrown me a life ring. It was literally like a sense of relief. I was like, oh, holy crap, I think I can do this. So that was amazing. So I basically stopped for a year. So that should be my happy ever after, and it's not. I don't know why I'm laughing. But basically, I did the nuts and bolts that year, the slow habit change. You know, there was still a lot of kind of addiction recovery language in the space. There wasn't the kind of stuff that I now bring to it, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was still, you know, but I was like doing day in, day out. I was putting together the toolkit. I was, you know, getting some of that sober time under my belt. I was blogging every day. I used writing as therapy, basically. Yeah. That was very therapeutic. But what it gave me is a space that was anonymous. So basically it gave me safety and it gave me connection with like-minded people. And it gave me that sort of boundary or accountability where I was seen. So for me, accountability is just that. I see you, you see me, so we've got a better chance of doing it. That's all that means to me, that word, right? So that's what that gave me. And I always say, you know, I went back after a year, 13 months, and what had happened is that I didn't have the sober toolkit. I didn't have what we were probably going to go on to talk about next. I had just stopped, but I didn't have a toolkit. And at that point I was sort of one of the early ones on the forums that were getting to a year, and I was going, well, I have no idea what I'm doing now, what's next. I'll halt there.
It's some of the things there that I sort of find really interesting is like that validation that you got, that, do you know what? I thought I was going mad, you know, because I can relate to that, because you sort of look outside, you talk to friends and doctors and they tell you it's normal.
Yeah.
Or no, you haven't got a problem or whatever. But I think what I identified, and it sounds like what you were persistently feeling, was that you didn't feel happy. And that should matter, shouldn't it? It should matter.
100%.
And sometimes people don't validate that. And I'm sure they don't do it on purpose. But nonetheless, you know, as we do, we look around our environment for, is anyone else doing this? Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
You know, you're not judging. You're not saying everyone's got a problem. You're just saying that I just feel differently about it. And I loved it. I actually got goosebumps when you said, you know, that you had 12 messages, because it must have felt amazing to have had that validation. But
it was absolutely, you know, having tried and stopped and tried and stopped and tried and, well, you know, messed up and tried again, and had that conversation for, you know, a good 15 years with myself. It took those comments in a safe space that I could relate to literally, that would turn the key. It was literally that moment, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's wonderful to hear. And the reason I sort of hover around that is because, you know, people that might be listening that might be going on a similar journey to you. And it's like, you know, have a bit of faith in yourself, you know, have a bit of trust in yourself. You are the best judge for yourself. Like ultimately, you know, we all make mistakes. We all have bad judgments at times, but something like that, I'm not sure you can, you know?
And I think that's true, that there's that sort of what characterizes, I think, what is one of those little red flags. If you are concerned about your drinking, and you are looking outside for confirmation, that is a little red flag to turn back in, because we lose our solid ground and we lose our foothold when a behavior or substance is starting to become problematic. So if you are doing that, that's your cue.
I love that. So that people might be looking elsewhere for their comfort, for some sort of validation or confirmation, but actually it's that act that tells you what you need to know. That's amazing. I love that perspective. That's a really nice way of thinking about it. So, you know, moving down the line, what led you to Mandy Manners Love Sober Movement and all that stuff, which I'm obviously super grateful even exists. So what was the story there?
Well, so in terms of, so there was a sort of a job thing that was going down, a career progression, shall we say,
Yeah.
and there was my sober progression, my life and my life journey sort of thing. And so I was gutted, you know, when I started, when I went back to drinking after that year, because in my head it was like, well, I've done a year, I've proved I haven't got a problem and this and this. And very quickly, like I can remember, it was after my daughter's birthday and I had a glass of champagne and it felt like I can do the sound, it went like a bass, like a big bass drop, but not in a good way,
Yeah.
like an airplane coming in to land, where I felt all of my neurotransmitters and my nervous system nuked by this, at that point, quite a small amount of alcohol for me, but because I'd not done it for a year
Yeah.
and I'd been, you know, rewiring and all the rest of it, unbeknownst to me, I have no idea about all of this stuff. And immediately the booze chatter started. You know, we talk about the wine witch and the addictive voice, that the argument in your head, yes, I will, no, I won't. That started immediately. And I remember I sat in the bath and I just went, oh, fuck. Like, I was like, I thought, like, I genuinely thought I was one person to get away with it. And I wasn't. So, anyway, so that led me then to a lot of looking, a lot of turning over stones, a lot of just trying to discover what it was that I needed. And I stumbled upon a few things. I stumbled upon coaching, and I was actually working with a coach who I'd met on Soberistas at the time. She was amazing. Yeah, so she wanted practice. I needed someone to, you know, coach me. So we did that. I knew in my heart, even though people kept saying things to me like on sober forums, like, you know, there was something about going back and looking at problems and this and that, you know, that sort of therapy place where you go back and you unpick it, like that 100% has a place. But I'd done that in my 30s. I'd done it in my 20s. And I was like, look, I kind of know the shape of that. I know what happened. And I knew again in my gut that I didn't want to focus on the past. It was like, I don't want to focus on what's wrong with me. And my gut, I didn't have the words really. It's like, I want to focus on what's right with me. So it was like I was crying out for some strength-based affirmation, like, it's your time to face the sunshine. Like, you are allowed to, you know, you're allowed to not dwell in the shadows anymore if you so choose. It's permission, right? Permission to play, permission to be. And that was what was calling me. And so I hit upon this thing. Something popped up on my, something, I don't know where it was, and it said the science of happiness. You can do this online course with Barclay and Harvard. And like, I love the learning, I love the science. And so I took this course, and I know we'll go on to talk about that in a bit. So I was getting all this knowledge on board, and I was training as the coach, and I knew that I wanted to work in this area, and I wanted to write, and I wanted to develop. And so I was writing a blog called Love Sober, and I was blogging, and my coach said to me, what do you want to do in like 5 years' time? You know, we had that chat, and I said, well, I'd really like to have written a book. I want to train as a coach. I'd like to be speaking about sobriety.
I love it. It's all the stuff you're doing. It's
I know.
fantastic.
Oh my God, the power of it, right? I can't believe it. You know, like when you have that support and the dots join up, like what can happen? You know, it's not to say life's perfect. I'm still really freaking impactful, but you know what, great things can happen and great resilience can come out of it as well. It can be light and shade, right, can't it? It can provide such a lot of sustenance for us. Anyway, blah blah, can't remember where I was. Oh yeah, my blog Love Sober. So I was terrified at the time to put it out there because I was all just behind the scenes on sober forums. This is again like 6 years ago, so
Wow, it's not that long
maybe,
ago.
no, it's not
No.
that long ago. And so I was worried that the mums at school would see it and they wouldn't let the kids play with my kids because that mummy wine culture was still really strong. I had a group of mum friends that I now wasn't kind of drinking with, but it was, I it was still that culture was still big, and I still had those fears.
Yeah.
Anyway, so my coach had said to me, okay, so what's the first step that you might want to do there? And I said, well, I suppose I need to come out of hiding and be visible so that other people can see me. And she was like, okay, right. And I was just terrified. That was proper stretch zone. Anyway, I pressed publish. And my blog went up, and Mandy read my blog. Right. So she know me a bit on Soberistas, but then had gone outside and loved my blog, Love Sober, and what I was talking about. So she did, like we always say, she's quite a good stalker. She'll just kind of network. So basically, Mandy, by her own admission, stalked me and found out about me, and then went, do you fancy doing a podcast? And I went, yeah, I'd love to. I was like, I've never even listened to one. I was like, yeah, fine, yeah, let's do it. And that was the moment. So we didn't even know what we were calling it. I said, well, I've got the blog Love Sober. Maybe we should call it Love Sober Podcast. She was like, yeah, I think it's really great. Why don't we do that? Anyway, and that's the moment it was all born, and, you know,
the rest
is history, right?
I just love how organic everything is with you two. It's just so organic, and just, it just has that meant to be feeling about it always. It's so lovely. No, it's really nice. Like, it's really nice. Stalker, that's going to tickle me all day.
She's stalker. Yeah. And then the thing is, right, so we always laugh. We're like, even though we're like, no, we're proper rad feminists, like we'll be really proper feminists. And then we were like, right, how do we do it? How do we do this podcast? And so we were like, I think we were just on some kind of recording app or something at the time, and then my husband said, oh, this mic might be quite good, so we both had to get the same mic, and then it was literally balanced on kitchen table with a tea towel draped over that, trying to get some decent sound
in there.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And then my husband, because he does quite a lot of music, he helped us kind of produce it, so he made it sound nice. And it was like beg, borrow, and steal. A friend of hers had written this jingle, so he gave us that. It was called Recovery, which is lovely, actually.
Oh, wow.
Put one of his old tunes. But
I do love the music to that, actually.
I know, bless you, yeah. And then we did it, and we sort of got it up. We were like, okay, where do we put it? Podbean, blah, blah, blah. And then we literally didn't know how to check our stats. We didn't know anyone was listening. We had no idea. We just used to get together for a chat and then like press, like, you know, publish.
Yeah.
And then I think it was about 5 months later, Mandy said, oh, you could check this. I found how you can check that the people are like, how many downloads you've had? We'd had thousands, right? Wow. Like, oh my God, like people are actually listening.
Yeah.
And at that point, we properly got the fear. We were like, oh, Jesus.
I was going to say, did that freak you right out?
Yeah, it's like, oh, no, people are actually listening to us. It's not just us having a chat. So we were like, oh. So we did get a little bit scared for a bit. And then we were like, oh, it doesn't matter. We're just having a chat. Like, we're having, that was all what it was supposed to be. Let's just talk about this. Mm. Like, we don't have to have the answers. We haven't got the answers. Who's got the answers? But if we just shine a light, if we just show up and tell our stories and our truths and how it feels for us, it gives permission, right? And it blows away the myths and the norms.
Yeah.
You know, that was the whole idea behind it. It was just let's have a chat about whatever comes up through, you know, about any of the stuff, parenting, mental health, but through that sober lens, because we wanted to keep the focus on sobriety being, it was our you know, our linchpin, I guess, to well-being, to all of our well-being. So it had to have that as the foundation, you know.
And you're right, though, it is. It's like some days through being sober, the win you get is, did I drink today? No.
Yeah.
And that's your win. You know, that's your win.
That's a win.
Yeah, that's okay.
What a win.
Yeah.
And what an amazing win, right?
Yeah. Some days are just rubbish, but you didn't drink, so it was a win, you know. And I could absolutely say, for like, your podcast is literally you two having a conversation sometimes, and I just laugh my head off. Like, some of the stuff you're talking about, I'm just like, I love it, because it's real. It's real stuff. It's what people are going through. And you know, when I became sober and chose to go alcohol free, a person that I worked with said, if you want to know why you drink, stop drinking. And actually those conversations that you have are the reason why, you know, some of them things that were triggering you, some of them things that were causing you to be stressed, and you look outside to your group and you know, you've got the mums that are drinking, they're all drinking. Well, that must be what I should do, you know? And you can just see how easy it is to fall into that trap. And when you start changing your behaviors, you inadvertently challenge other people's without even saying anything, you know? And it becomes a difficult space. And I've been through that, and I know that you have. And I think you can't go sober or make a change of that without it happening, can you? It's not necessarily a bad thing either. It's just a difficult time. Yeah. It's challenging.
It's growth, basically, essentially. It's growth and it's evolution. And with that, you know, I just go back to the seasons. I'm thinking quite a lot about this at the moment because this is not a shameless plug. We've just finished our second book. And that is very much about the kind of cycles of life.
Yeah.
And the fact is that some things you have to have the die off in autumn and the rest to then make space for new growth. Yeah. And I really do think we go through life cycles and life cycles and life cycles and sobriety cycles. You know, we don't have to do it all at once. We're not going to be, we will never be perfect, shiny, happy people. And it's like, that's not about that. It's about clearing space for us to authentically kind of grow in our lives. That's why I think it's like the welcome mat.
That's a really lovely way of putting it, because it's like I acknowledged that something similar the other day when my son was having growing pains. Mm-hmm. And I was like, even when you're growing, there's pain.
You know,
it's part of the process, right? You know, there is pain there always. And actually, it's not always a bad thing. Sometimes it's an indicator, you know, of growth, like you say, exactly as you say. Love it. Love it. You know, I love the way you use words. I really do. I love the words that you use. It's always nice to listen to.
Imagine that whenever you felt stuck, low in confidence, or just felt unsure about something, you had somewhere to go. I'm not talking about a self-help book or an online guru. I'm talking about actual space online where we can come together with real people and access actionable tools to help you get from where you are now to where you'd like to be. So that's what we've built, the School of Self-Development. We're going to provide you with one-to-one self-development coaching, on-demand courses, growth articles, and insights from industry leaders in self-development. And the best part, a community that you can feel part of and feel safe when you're reaching out for support. So whether you need help plucking up the courage to finally change careers, commit to a major decision, or simply be able to commit more time to your family, whatever the goal, ambition, or aspiration is, the School of Self-Development was made for you. Visit our website, schoolofselfdevelopment.com, and make sure you book in time to say hello. School of Self-Development, your number one source of self-development.
You know, obviously now we know the history, and we know that you started Love Sober with Mandy, and, you know, through your time coaching and through your podcast, you must have heard some pretty unbelievable stories. I mean, which ones do you think have been the most impactful that have taught you something, or you've taken something away and gone, wow, you know, what sort of conversation?
Do you know, I feel like, you know, this sounds like a platitude about everyone's amazing, but I do think that. I do feel like when, you know, you hear the stories, everyone's kind of, I always feel like everyone is kind of ordinary and extraordinary. Like all of our lives, no matter how ordinary you might feel, there are moments of the extraordinary, many, many of them, and things that people have overcome. And because we're in this space, because we're in this sober space, or some people call it recovery space, you get people who are recoveries, therefore they have overcome stuff. So I would say, I would like to caveat that, because I genuinely believe it, and why I love this space so much. I think though that, and this is a fella that came to mind the other day, I think Michael Maisie's story really touched me. And Michael Maisie, he just does amazing work in this space. And he wrote the book Young Offender Have you heard of him?
I haven't actually. No.
Okay, so he's sober. He's been on the sober path. Can't remember how many years. He did a sort of a more traditional recovery path through AA and stuff. But he was from East London, and had an incredibly challenging childhood. Like, you know, there was drug, like severe drug addiction and abuse and stuff like that laced through it. And he ended up in Feltham Young Offenders Centre. So he went to prison.
Right.
And it was during his, and you know, it was like that story of looking for a band of brothers, like so many boys.
Yeah.
So much of that culture when you're, you know, you're seeking, you're searching, and you end up in the wrong places. And by all rights, if you look at the stats, that should have been it for him. That should have been a life of crime, really. And what he did is he entered, you know, he got sober. I think they had some kind of therapy in prison. And he basically now lives in Devon with his beautiful wife. And I think he's got two or three kids. And he runs, it's almost like, it's like sharing circles for men.
Mm.
And places for men to go, like retreats.
Yeah, yeah.
But to go and do it for blokes. Because there's so many spaces for women now, which is amazing. But, you know, it's so brilliant when you see a fella doing it for the other men.
Mm.
And how needed that is. So he does a lot for charity. And, yeah, he wrote a book called Young Offender about his time in prison.
What was his name again?
Michael Maisie, and
yeah.
He is a glorious human being. He just is, you know. He's got he's like one of those beautiful open hearts, you know.
Yeah.
He's such a lovely, lovely guy.
That's nice though, isn't it? Because a lot of the time with the podcast, and I get it as well, is you hear some pretty difficult to hear stories. But what we always try to do, and the reason why people come on podcasts, is because it's there to inspire. And it's not necessarily that happy ending, but it's like, hey, there was a pathway. There's always a pathway, you know. There's always a pathway to some sort of different life, you know.
Yeah.
And
and when I spoke to him about it on the podcast, and it was like I think he fitted into that. You know, I used to work on the press, and it was like a brilliant kind of rags to riches story, like a brilliant, like, you know, a sort of classical narrative to hero journey.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we talked about it, it was like we were reflecting on, but every single day, he and you and I, but he at that particular point had those choices many, many times a day to pick up a drink, to do whatever he did. And I just wanted to really honour those millions and millions of small choices that he had all along the way, not just like the hero love moments,
that.
Right?
Yeah, love that.
Because that's what allies are made up of.
They are. Yeah. I always say that to clients. I say, like, you know, something visual like bodybuilding, people only see the end result. They don't see the reps. They don't see the hours and hours in the gym, the sacrifices, the dedication. Yeah. They don't see all that stuff. Yeah. They just see the body, you know? And it's because it's such a visual thing, you know? So I quite often use that as an example. But yeah, I'm going to definitely look into him. He sounds like somebody I'd love to talk to.
You should totally talk to him.
I'd love to talk to him. He sounds like a wonderful chap.
You two need to know each other.
And I mean, obviously, you know, you're deep in the sobriety world now, and you've been deep in the challenges of alcohol, and you've seen lots of different success stories. But I mean, dry January, January is coming up, or we're in January when this comes out probably. And what opportunities does that present? Because what I suppose I'm getting at is that we're not necessarily talking about being an alcoholic. We could just be talking about grey area drinking, problematic drinking, and just generally having a feeling that you drink too much and having that validated. Maybe just talk just briefly. I mean, just the last question, then we're going to move on to the happy stuff. But it's more like, what opportunity does dry January bring, and sort of the classification of sort of grey area drinking and problematic drinking over sort of being technically an alcoholic?
Okay, yeah. So in kind of culturally understood terms and TV media, whatever, we've kind of got used to this idea that alcoholics, there's the normal people, then there's the alcoholics who are, you know, rock bottom, vodka on the cornflakes kind of all wheels off the wagon sort of stereotype. And the idea, the grey area of drinking, it's like the World Health Organization have not used alcoholic as a diagnostic term. I mean, it's not been used as a diagnostic term since the 80s or something. And so the World Health Organization see it as a spectrum. So, and it's hazardous and harmful, dependent, and there's the one other, I can't remember, my brain's gone to mush.
It's all right.
But anyway, you could look it up on the World Health Organization. Yeah. So we have, so hazardous and harmful, it can be anywhere. It can be your binge. Mm. So you might think, for me, it was like I couldn't consistently moderate. Like sometimes I could have a glass. It wasn't like that was the starter gun and then that would be it. And I would, you know, be plastered every single time I drank, but it was really unpredictable.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if that's you, you are not going to fit into the any kind of particular box.
No.
But it might still be causing you harm and sleepless nights and anxiety.
Yeah.
So that's where the grey area of drinking is. And if you have, I mean, I can't believe how much better I feel.
Yeah.
Like, quite simply, like, I cannot believe it. So dry January can be, I mean, it's lovely because it's a kind of socially acceptable way for people to take a break, which is always going to be good.
Might need it after Christmas as well.
Might need it after Christmas, yeah. And also that reflective, so to not just do it and just go, oh, right, okay, but actually try and engage with it is what I would say, and do some kind of reflective, you know, ask yourself those questions, how do I feel?
Yeah.
Track your progress, join in with a challenge with people, you know, get that accountability with each other. I see you, you see me, let's chat it through, you know, that thing. And really, and take it as that opportunity to sort of have a pause and have a really good look at it. See what comes up. You know, you're going to learn a lot, even if you just do dry January. You might love it. So many people love it. And then either return, you know, a lot of people on it who are sober, long-term choosing alcohol-free, started with the dry January. So
it's a great opportunity. It is. And I think, you know, like you say, you know, that sometimes people get to the end of the month and it's like, it's almost like an obligation to start drinking again. You know, there's that feeling of, oh, well, got to start drinking again. It's like, well, you know, you don't have to, right? And it's like,
for me,
what going alcohol-free gave me was freedom. That's the word. It's literally the word I use all the time. It's given me freedom because it felt like a commitment, which is a weird feeling. It felt like a commitment to me that, oh, I had to drink and then I realized I didn't. So I'm glad you say that. Yeah. And again, the way that you classified that gray area drinking, I wanted to bring that to attention because, you know, people go, well, I'm not an alcoholic. Well, that doesn't have to be the case. Sometimes if you've got an issue with it or you've got a feeling around it, sometimes it could just be a feeling, then, you know, there are options. That's what I'm trying to get to. And this is one of them.
And it really is. And the other thing that I point out about that, I think something that really helped me, there's a writer called Jack Timpany, who wrote a book right back in the 90s, I think 80s or 90s, called Rational Recovery. And that was a real sort of answer to that traditionally AA time at that point. And it was that he categorized the issue of actually of addiction as when you get the tug of war. So you can be using a substance, you can be overusing it, but you might not, that might be fine for you. That's a whole other different point from his perspective. But once you start having that tug of war, I'm going to say no, and then I do, I regret it. Once I've got that bargaining, it's like two parts of your brain. That's a really useful indicator of actually it's time to, you know, have a good look at that.
Yeah, but that's two good indicators you've given now. That's brilliant as well, because they're really tangible. Like there's stuff that you go, you know what, she's right, I feel that. I feel that. Like sometimes it just hits you like a brick. You're like, yeah.
Sorry guys listening.
No. No, sometimes it is, it's just like, yeah, that's me. Like, okay, thank you for that. And I hope that people get something from that, even if it's just a little bit of contemplation. I really do. Mm. That's my hope. That value.
And almost there. See it as a treat as well. Like, yeah. I know it's unbelievable, but God, and allow yourself to rest. It's like you could, I like to see it as almost like pregnancy. It's like, sorry for all you guys out there, but you know, like if you imagine that of just like, you know, that point of just, you know, take all the rules off, you're allowed to kind of rest and have a little bit of exploration and do a bit of pampering.
Yeah. Well,
you know, it could be a treat, right?
No, you're right. You know, the strange things that I've been up to since I've been so far, it's just like you wouldn't have convinced me I'll be doing some of the stuff I do. It's crazy. But moving on.
That's another podcast. That's a different.
I left my other podcast, my late one. So we're going to move on to a subject now that you're really passionate about. I've heard you talk about it quite a few times, and that's the science of happiness. It just sounds lovely, I think, the science of happiness. But there's going to be many people that are like, what's that? So what is the science of happiness?
Oh, man, how long you got? the science of happiness is basically, it's like, social science, you know, like sociology, psychology, and all of those, like those humanities, but the sort of social sciences. So the science of happiness is looking at what's right with us as a species, and how to be collect. It's like how to boost those bits of happiness and well-being that we have any kind of control over. Not just individually, but collectively. So it involves, you know, changing society. It can influence like legislation, you know, and government kind of decisions. And it has done. So basically, yeah, it's like using things like psychology. It's using things like evolutionary theory. It's using things like looking at the neuroscience and taking lab tests. To pull together scientific evidence for what makes us well and happy. And I'm like, oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Because all the science. So they use things like they looked at things like a gratitude practice, for example.
Yeah.
Because it's like things that we know, it's like ancient wisdoms, right? We know that apparently that's good for us, right? Mm. And it shows, so they did things like they tested how much gratitude is the optimum amount of gratitude.
Yeah,
they tested it with people. Like if you have to be grateful every day, it can make people feel pissed off. I love that.
That is funny.
Like, oh, not my gratitude list, get off.
Bloody gratitude becoming a thing.
Oh,
right?
Man, I'm so ungrateful for my gratitude. I'm really fed up with it. So, they did lab tests. They collected metadata as well from worldwide apps. They did a thing about mindfulness as well, and because of technology, they could test a simple mindfulness practice on millions of people across the globe and collate all this evidence. And so what they did is they found that there was about 20% of our happiness that we could actually do something about. And it's things like, so the things that they have talked about as being evidence-based practices. So this isn't about we've all got to feel happy all the time. The way I see it is it's like a scaffold for living. And it's like in these times of so much information, information overload, a lot of noise, they're almost like really good tenets, practical tenets for being well and living well. So yeah, like I said, a scaffold. So it's things like awe. So you can then add it into your day. So some kind of awe practice. When we go outside and we experience awe, like we're in the presence of something greater.
Yeah.
Like the rolling waves, or like being forest bathing, or like looking out. I love like the Tate Modern, going in there and seeing this amazing thing. It resizes our problems. Like we get a sense of perspective. We're like, okay, there's a bigger picture. Quite literally, there's a bigger picture. But then if you test it, it lowers inflammation. It boosts serotonin levels. So they do all this science about it.
Wow.
Okay. So you can add a bit of awe into your day. Then the other thing they look at very heavily is that kind of the fact that, and this, right, this changed my life, that we have succeeded as a species, not because we're assholes, but because we are really pro-social and really nurturing, and our mammalian connections to each other actually have meant that we're very successful in groups. And so they looked at things like the effect of kindness, random acts of kindness on people. So if you witness a video, they played people videos of people being kind to each other, the same areas of the brain light up as when someone's kind to you.
That's so true.
So there's this reciprocity. And once they saw that, because I realized I've been carrying around this sort of kind of Machiavellian thing about I felt very bad. I almost felt bad about being human. I was like, man, we're doing this, that. It's really not nice what we're doing to this. And once I flipped that, once I saw through studying science of happiness about most of us are about connection, most of us about kindness, I saw it everywhere. You know, I saw a young kid helping an old lady across the street, someone giving their parking ticket to someone else, a mum holding a baby's hand, someone hugging each other goodbye, me chatting to someone at a till. And I literally, it's like the scales fell away from my eyes and I saw connection everywhere.
Yeah.
And that was like freaking life changing for me because I'd been all locked up and felt all separate.
Yeah, I love that. It's like what I think it's Mel Robbins that says, what you focus on grows stronger.
Yeah.
And it is that, isn't it? Like, I think we spend a lot of the time focusing, especially recently with all of the stuff with governments and pandemics and, you know, financial stuff. It's very easy just to focus on that because it's everywhere and it's a problem. But actually, like you're saying, them everyday things that you are close to, that you witness, that you're around, them small things, they're what's real.
That's what's in our life, not all the information. And it is, and it's sort of a big element of this now that I work now with the nervous system and how to regulate, you know, so whether to, if you're in fight flight, how to calm yourself, or if you're a bit locked up, how to bring yourself up into that open receptive state. Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of the science for happiness, tips and tools like awe, gratitude, connection, they help with all of that. So it's not just about what's happening in the brain. It's like what's happening in the body to make us essentially feel safe, grounded, connected with bits of light, you know, with bits of being lit up. I mean, it's that really.
Yeah. It's very simple. I find
it's got all the science behind it. Yeah. Where it's all like, oh my God, I can see the brain scan of somebody experiencing forgiveness. That's
me being a right now. No, but that's cool. I think that's really cool. I mean, I'm loving this. What I'm hearing, you know, we can only affect 20% of our happiness. Things like gratitude, mindfulness, kindness. Mm. It's really obvious, but we don't do it.
It's the old wisdoms.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is, and it's all proven to make us feel better. And I honestly think, see, when you stop drinking, what you've been doing generally for most of us that have developed some kind of relationship with it is outsource these kinds of things to alcohol. So we've been looking to it for confidence, to de-stress us, or to give us that almost false feeling of connection. Well, actually it doesn't, it kind of numbs you out. But what it will do is give you that immediate sort of shut off, so that it gives you the illusion of that. So what we do when we take the alcohol away, we do need the toolkit, or we need a scaffold for living. We need someone to take us by the hand and go, you know what, this is going to be a much better idea to help you relax, love. Do you know what?
Bloody brilliant. That I love that. That's absolutely great. That really is. I love that. I mean, We're winding up now, but I mean, I just wanted to ask another couple of questions because that's how I roll. And you know, what would you say, just quickly, are the pillars of the science of happiness? The real sort of,
what are they? So you've got so compassion and self-compassion is huge. You know, anything that sort of connects us and helps us get out of that defensive fight flight thing. And I do think, you know, I do a lot of yoga. So I'm really sorry about that. But no, that sort of that idea that it has to kind of start with us as well, that sort of self-compassion, that non-harming. Yeah. That was a big thing for me in the alcohol journey, is when I realized that my choice not to drink was essentially to stop harming myself.
Mm.
That started really being of a pillar for me. So yeah, compassion, self-compassion, empathy. There's a lot on there. If you're interested in looking, it's the Greater Good Science Center.
Nice.
So if you link that, people can go. There's loads of free resources. There's
I'll stick that link in there.
Conflict resolution, like, so that forgiveness, self-forgiveness, and what the mechanics of it are as well. They're not just platitudes. It's like, how do we go through the process of something? And they will give you really clear steps how to do it. Gratitude, and apparently 3 times a week.
Not every day, otherwise it becomes a bit of a burden.
When they tested people, that was like, yeah, it was a bit too much. Mindfulness is very, very important as well. So that kind of coming back, being present in the moment. Yeah. And they do a lot. Oh God, I really want to talk about flow and creativity. That's all, again, really important, because it shuts off the brain, gives us space, and helps us, you know, replenish. That's all. And the last bit I would say about this, because, you know, if you're listening in and you just say, oh, bloody hell, that sounds like a lot of work. How much more work have I got to do? I just thought I might just have a bit of a rest. It's absolutely fine, because they also say that the fit, when you're testing all these things, and that brings it back to you, is what is your unique recipe and what is a good fit for you? And if you hate a loving kindness meditation like I do, like, it makes me want to run out, and, well, I'm better at it now, but, you know, if it kind of irritates you, that's not a good fit. Leave it. That might be 10 years down the line. It might never be your bag. So that, you know, it's about your unique inquiry into what lights you up and what makes you tick, basically.
Bit of self-exploration, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, just like, and that's what I love about being alcohol free, is it gives you that space and that freedom to explore what you like, and actually be able to buy into your feelings, knowing that they're yours and they're not being enhanced by something else. Yeah. You know, and it's just a really lovely, and sometimes that can be anger, sometimes that can be, do you know, what, you've really annoyed me, but,
and that's important,
it is, because it's you expressing yourself. And actually, a lot of the time, I think the conflict comes from denying those feelings, saying, hey, look, I'm not angry. Yes, you are. You know, I've met people in the past, not my wife, never my wife, who would say to me, you know, I'm not angry. I'm like, I don't believe you.
You know, it's that authenticity, like you said, about, you know, your genuine feelings, and anger is that sign that a boundary is being crossed. And it is a healthy, and the way we need to do it is discharge that energy charge from the body, you know, and advocate for our needs, but in those healthy ways, not destructive ways.
Yeah, right? Batting for yourself, man. You know, going to bat for yourself.
100%. Yeah, and that's really, really important. And again, like, alcohol being, like, my big boundary was like, I need to say no to this so that I can say yes to all this other stuff. That's a boundary.
Yeah, you know? Love it. There's going to be people that listen to this and say, sounds a little bit like toxic positivity. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so if this, again, like we said, is this not about being happy and joyous and happy clappy all the time? The way I quite like to look at it is that if you take a sort of an overarching approach to your life, so a longer time frame, say, so it's not about chasing down the moment and rinsing the moment and that sort of hedonism, because that's the other side of it. It's like, I've just got to be, we're going to go. Yeah, we're going to go. It's like, that's not sustainable. So the overarching happiness, the overarching well-being is not just a sparkly frame of mind. It's like, it's the second time I've used it. It's almost like a bass beat. It's like a heartbeat underneath that keeps going and gently making good decisions in line with your values and applying the self-care is going to give you overall well-being and happiness. It's not just about a peak and chasing that peak. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, because it's not. It takes the demand for effort out of it, because it's consistent, it's doable, you can do it all the time. It's not like something that you get tired of. Like sometimes exercise, people can take it too far and they fatigue themselves. And if you fatigue yourself on happiness, imagine that.
Oh God.
That would be awful.
Oh my gosh.
I've done gratitude 3 times a day. Drove me crazy.
Too much. It's too much. Yeah. And it's that, because it's, you know, it is that difference between seeing like what it's, you then have to ask, well, what is happiness? And happiness is that much sort of gentler kind of feeling of well-being and connectivity.
Yeah.
To your meaning, your purpose, and it's like that rounded thing, not just a peak in emotion, you know. So it's sort of reframing that meaning a little bit. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you're saying like the science of happiness is something you can do consistently, but toxic positivity is you putting on an act.
Yeah.
And that's fatiguing. If you happen to, it's like when you tell a lie and you have to remember the lie, and there's fatigue and all sorts of stuff that comes with that. So I love
that. Right. And the science of happiness is essentially sort of tools. So they are a set of practices you can do for your mental health and your well-being. They're not a kind of a state of denial sort of thing of toxic positivity. Yeah.
Perfect. Love that. Yeah. Listen, this has been amazing. You're amazing. I've loved this conversation. It's been super fun. And I feel like I might get you back on to talk about flow. I feel like that could fill an hour easy.
Oh, I'd love to talk about a bit of flow. We could do some interpretive dancing, couldn't we?
Well,
we don't know. I'm joking. I just wanted to see the look of terror on your face.
Well, that was definitely there. No, nobody wants to see me dance. Believe me, no one wants to see that. Tell people where they can find you and anything you want to draw their attention to, because I'm sure people are going to want to check you out after this.
Yeah, the easiest way is to go to lovesober.com, and that's where everything lives. We do courses. We've got a 6-week course that goes with the book. So we've got Love Yourself Sober, the book. And then we've got Love Yourself Sober, the course.
Yeah.
But just go to lovesober.com and you'll find the podcast, you'll find free stuff, you find the community there.
I mean, we don't know if it's going to happen yet, but we're going to try and do a little something in the new year to help give people a bit of value and support, hopefully. But it depends on schedules and stuff, I suspect. But we'll do our best.
We certainly will.
We'll do our best. But thank you so much, Kate. And you are a credit to the industry. Really are.
Aww,
I mean that,
you
know. And we shall catch up soon.
Yeah, it's been so lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Wow, I really feel like we've got off to a good start here in 2022. Speaking to Dave on the last episode, speaking to Kate on this episode, two really incredible guests with so much knowledge. I feel quite lucky and honoured. So thank you to Dave for earlier in the month, and thank you so much for today, Kate. Really always appreciate you. Kate also took part in an interview, our first ever expert coaching conversation on the School of Self-Development group, just giving advice. And we also coupled together the School of Self-Development with Love Sober to create a worksheet that people can work through the month. It really has been quite successful as well, and lots of people have got involved and really enjoyed it. It is more of a private thing, so you know, a lot of private messages have been going on. And it's just been a wonderful thing to see, and to just watch and be witness to people discovering so many wonderful things about themselves that they never realised. Favourite part of my job for sure, no doubt about that. So for those who haven't joined the School of Self-Development yet, we'd love to welcome you into our community. This group is really growing quite fast. It's full of so many remarkable people that you can learn from and grow with. So click on the link in the show notes and join today. We'd love to welcome you on board. If you fancy any further perspective on self-development, come and find me on YouTube and social media by searching The Self-Development Coach. Thanks again to my podcast producer, Charlie. And I'll catch you next time for another episode of The Self-Development Podcast.